Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with photojournalist Ted Jackson, author of You Ought to Do a Story About Me, Addiction, An Unlikely Friendship, and The Endless Quest for Redemption. Jackson has had a long and distinguished career in more than three decades at the Times-Picayune. He was part of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams. One won the prize in 1997 for the Oceans of Trouble series, the other in 2006 for Katrina coverage. In 2017, he received the newspaper's first Jim Amos Award, named for the longtime executive editor of the Times-Picayune. Ted and his wife Nancy live in Covington, and today we're talking about his new book, You Ought to Do a Story About Me, Addiction, An Unlikely Friendship, and the Endless Quest for Redemption. Ted Jackson, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here talking with you.
Now, this is a book some 30 years in the making. It has its origins in a story you photographed for the paper in 1990. And you went out, cameras at the ready, looking for a homeless encampment. And what did you find instead?
Well, I was looking for this encampment. It was supposed to be kind of unique looking. And when I got there, the camp was turned upside down. There were no people there. I was very disappointed that this vision I had for this story had disappeared and was messed up. So I was walking back to my car. And about halfway there, I kind of came upon a homeless man sleeping on a rusty mattress and covered over with a plastic sheet. I thought his camp looked unique. I climbed up on the bridge just a little bit and shot directly down on it and made a picture, but I really didn't think much about it. Thought I'd never use it. But I woke him up to ask him what had happened to the other camp. And we talked for a few minutes, and he said, "Why do you want to know?" And I told him I was with the newspaper and I was wanting to do a story on homelessness, and he kind of got quiet for just a second. Then he said, "You ought to do a story about me." And I asked him why, and he said, "Because I've played in three Super Bowls." I was a bit stunned, but frankly, I didn't believe him. So I thanked him for his time, and I got his name, and I drove as fast as I could back to the newspaper office, which was only about eight blocks away from that spot. And I bypassed the photo lab, the photo desk, and went straight to the sports department. And I asked Tim Ellerby, who was the editor at the time, and I said, "Has anyone ever heard of a guy named Jackie Wallace?" And every head popped up.
I love that moment. I could just imagine that so clearly.
And they filled me in. And that he had, you know, played for the Vikings and the Colts and the Rams, and had played in actually was two Super Bowls instead of the three, like he had said. But he was on the team for one Super Bowl that he had an injury that wasn't football related. It was a shoulder problem. So he couldn't play in that first one, but he played in two and had just incredible game in his first one that was actually played here at Tulane Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to be the first game in the Superdome, but it wasn't ready yet. And so they played in the Tulane Stadium. And he had a super game against Terry Bradshaw, who ironically became his nemesis.
Right.
His whole career.
Now, You Ought to Do a Story About Me as something journalists hear all the time, you know?
All the time.
But you found the one. You found the one who really deserved it.
But boy, I really learned how to listen when people tell me that. And I don't miss those anymore. I listen, and maybe it is, maybe it's not. And but boy, this one was quite the story.
This book will appeal to so many different types of readers because it's so many things, for starters. It's an amazing chronicle of what it takes to make it in the NFL. The hope, the effort, the heartbreak, the problems with repeated head trauma? And how do these guys transition from the bright lights of public adulation to ordinary life again?
That's right. It's very hard for them. I mean, we look at Brett Favre, who kept going back and kept going back. And I suddenly realized that what they're giving up is everything that they've ever worked for, and more than just the football and the game itself. They're giving up their friends and the camaraderie and the locker room, and it means a lot to them. And for Jackie, you know, he could see it slipping away, and it was crushing him to realize that the younger guys were faster than him, that he wasn't as quick as he used to be, and it was very hard for him. He really worked hard to stay in the game as long as he could.
And that story in 1990 was a story that made a terrific difference for Jackie Wallace, because the community, one of his communities, and you have a lot of communities in this book, rallied around him, and that was the community of St. Aug.
That's right. St. Aug is where he played in high school, where he was a star quarterback. And one of his friends in particular was the running back when he was playing at the time, was now one of the assistant football coaches, was Burton Burns. Burton was assigned by the principal there at the time to go and try to find Jackie the next day. And Burton didn't go alone. There were about five or six guys that all, headed out. And the directions in the story in the paper were very clear exactly where he was. But they were very uncomfortable in that environment, but they went anyway. And they found him right where he was supposed to be. And he woke up, and it became a conversation like you would have with someone you saw on the front porch. How are you, Jackie? And he was saying, hey, what you doing here? And so they were able to get him off the street, and they had a plan for him. They moved him to a rehab center in Baltimore where he got treatment and had a just remarkable recovery after that.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Ted Jackson, author of You Ought to Do a Story About Me, Addiction, An Unlikely Friendship, and The Endless Quest for Redemption. So there are various communities of faith and communities that help the addicts and homeless in this book. So talk about some of your experiences with them, the New Orleans Mission, Ozanam Inn, Gateway, Alcoholics Anonymous, and Narcotics Anonymous chapters. I mean, you really dove deeply into these efforts.
Yes, they were so important to Jackie and his survival. And he had learned at one point to play the homeless game, where he would go from one to the other and then stay the 30 days that they allowed, and then he'd move to the next one. And they all knew it. They knew Jackie, and they still wanted to help him. And one of the remarkable things about Jackie is that he's so lovable. He's just so sweet. And he has the problem of addiction, which led to his homelessness, but he still takes every effort he can to help other people around him. And so that creates this bond with the other men that he's with, and his teammates and his friends, everybody that knows him, all say the same thing, that he's just so giving. At one point when Jackie was missing, after he left Baltimore in a bad state, after he was there for 12 years, I did a story with Richard Webster for the Times-Picayune on the New Orleans Mission. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to do a deep dive and to find out what it was like to be there. And we did not go undercover. This was just, we wanted to go through the intake, sleep there that night, eat the food, talk to the men, just as if we were homeless. And it was eye-opening. It was not what I expected. I had to do the intake with probably about 20 minutes or so of embarrassing questions.
Mm-hmm.
It was very sobering, but when I went to bed that night, I was, listening to the men sing in the darkness and shuffling around and trying to find comfort and reading their Bibles, and all these things were just, swirling through my mind. And of course, the whole night I had spent looking for Jackie, thinking that, maybe he's here, maybe he'll show up, maybe someone here knows him. But when nobody even remembered his name anymore, it really disturbed me that he was just getting lost in the shuffle and somewhere out there. And frankly, I figured he was dead. But I made my mind up that night when I went to sleep. I said, I'm going to find it. I need to find out what happened to Jackie.
Mm-hmm. Well, so many times, terrible times, you are so close to one another. It's kind of scary. You open the book with this scene of him considering suicide, and you're photographing something at the World War II Museum, and you're just, if you'd looked another way with your camera, you might have seen him on the bridge.
I was literally right there. And yeah, that's haunting to me that I had looked for him for so long, but yet it was all kind of superficial. You know, I wondered where he was. And when I'd see the man on the sidewalk with a sign saying, I need, you know, money for food, I'd look close at the face. I said, you know, what would his face look like today after all these years? And when I went through a homeless camp or a story for the Picayune or whatever, I would look for the face, and I'd ask when I went to the shelters. But other than that, I had not made a serious effort. That bothered me.
And even during Katrina, when you described setting off in the Times-Picayune in that boat, and Jackie was just across the road at OPP.
He was right across the street. And I didn't discover that until we were way deep into writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me the story about, you know, where he was that night and how the water was coming in the jail and all that, and how they had to get them out by boat. I'm saying, are you kidding me? Are you serious? You were there that night? And the paths just crossed back and forth, which tells me that this is more than just Ted wanting to write a book or Jackie living a bizarre life. There's some divine guidance going on here. It's interesting that when Jackie and I talk, we often link back to that day under the bridge. Jackie told me one day, he said, I really believe that I was given the ability to play sports so that I could go to the NFL and then things would happen to me to create a story, and then I would be homeless under the bridge specifically so that I could meet you that day.
Wow.
And I said, that's just amazing, because I feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel the same way that I grew up as a, you know, even as a child, I love to draw. I love to paint. I love the camera. I discovered storytelling. It all culminated that day when I met you, and you gave me the story of my life. We just really feel it sends chills up our spine to think about that meeting that day.
Oh, and it's destiny, obviously. Now, for so many readers, this is going to be a great, great chronicle of spiritual struggle. And Jackie was a man of faith, as are you. Anybody can understand the fact that you're feeling chosen to tell this story. So talk a little bit about Jackie's spiritual struggles in your own, because you did go through times of real worry and, you know, why am I doing this?
Well, I mean, I grew up in, you know, the segregated South and in South Mississippi, and during the civil rights struggle, and horrible things were happening in my very own town that I didn't know about when I was a child. But it took me decades to kind of piece that all together, because my parents didn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They shielded us from the church bombings and the freedom marches and all those things. We just didn't know a thing about it. And my wife and I marvel at it. She was 2 years younger than me, so she even heard less, but she remembers the same thing. And so, you know, trying to piece all that together in a spiritual context, there was a lot of learning to do, especially in high school. I had never heard the word housing project before. I'd never paid attention to housing projects, and we didn't have that much poverty where we were, you know, in that kind of urban setting. It was, it was country life. But anyway, when I came to New Orleans, there was a lot of education for me. The stories that I had learned in Bible class and in sermons just stuck with me as I did my assignments in the housing projects. They were just haunting to me. So I really struggled with that for a long time, because I really felt like I had learned to do the right thing regardless of the cost, but yet what did that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
I had learned to help the poor, but what did that really mean? And there were some Bible verses that really stuck with me. You commit your thoughts to the Lord, and your thoughts will be established. And this one specific verse is, if a man shuts his ears to the cry of the poor, he too will cry out and not be answered. And I'm thinking, really? And I'd never heard that before. And here I am looking at the poverty around me and trying to process that. Oh, I could just tell you stories after stories that I've learned about faith in those settings.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with Ted Jackson, author of You Ought to Do a Story About Me, Addiction, An Unlikely Friendship, and The Endless Quest for Redemption. Now, this book really bears witness to Jackie's life, as the best journalism does, but it also shows what journalism can do. That final story you did for the Times-Picayune about Jackie was the best read story in the newspaper's history. And even the first stories changed his life utterly. And I love the way you describe how he kept those photographs that you took of him as kind of talismans.
Yeah, well, I went to visit him in Baltimore when he was out of rehab, and he had invited me to come up to his wedding. He had met a woman, and they got married, and he was having a party to celebrate the five-year anniversary of our meeting under the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up, and he showed me his new workplace, his locker room at the Baltimore Arena. Said he, I want to show you something. And he opened up his locker, and there was the photos. He said, I have to look at these every day so I don't end up back where I started. And Jackie is a very sensitive human being. And like I said before, he's so sweet and giving and compassionate. But I was trying to take a picture of him opening his locker. I was trying to take a picture, and my eyes were so welled up with tears, I couldn't focus.
Mm.
And you just suddenly realize that, that this change has happened because of a photograph. What a marvelous responsibility that is.
Mm-hmm.
How that makes you feel. But then, but he's also telling me at the same time that he's fragile.
When's the last time you saw him?
I saw him a week ago.
Has he seen the book yet?
Oh, he's worn it out. Yeah, Jackie in the last few years has had two hip surgeries. We call it football, NFL hips and knees.
Mm-hmm.
So he struggles to get around. He gets around on a walker these days. And it's one of the kind that has a seat in it so he can rest when he gets weary. And he keeps the book in that seat.
Oh, wow.
Along with his Bible and his group photo of his family, his brothers and sisters. And it's just a sweet thing. But that book is so tattered. The cover's almost worn off of it. Because it's a proof copy, and it was a paperback. And I can't wait to give him his hardcover so we can have a second go at that.
Yeah.
but he shows it to everybody he sees.
It's an honor for a subject to feel worthy of a book. It's a great gift that you give to them with your time and attention and years of writing. But it also gives you a gift. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the process of writing this book and what it did to look at your own life through this lens and over this time period.
Yeah, it truly is a gift. I've basically learned to write through this process. And the greatest gift is that when I first met Jackie, he was so honest and open with his life to me. There is not a single question that I can ask him that he will not just tell me everything. Mm-hmm. And, at times I felt like, well, that's going to end next month or next week. Next time he'll start shutting down or he'll find it too embarrassing to talk about. But he wants this story out. He wants people to see his life as a cautionary tale, if you will. And here's what happened to me. Don't let this happen to you. That's an incredible gift for a writer or a journalist of any sort. I would sit at my desk and I would try to put the words on the screen that, reflected what I saw and what I heard and what I felt and smelled. And sometimes I pounded the desk sometimes thinking, what in the world made me think I could do this?
Mm.
But I would just put my head back down and get back to it, and realizing I had this incredible opportunity laying here in front of me. and I can't screw this up. I just can't. And of course, I sold this project to HarperCollins without a last chapter in my proposal. You don't know where the story's going. You know, Jackie's writing the last chapter right now, and you know, what kind of ending will this be? And so I would go to bed every night and think about what happened that day and when I talked to Jackie the last time, and how things were not going the way I wanted them to, and his health was deteriorating in ways that I found very troubling. And some people say that their hair falls out when they worry so much, and mine left me a long time ago. But what little I had left literally was starting to turn white because of the struggle that I was going through with this project. I wanted it to turn out the way I wanted it. And I literally, one night when I was praying before going to sleep, which was hard to come by at that time, I suddenly stopped praying for the story to end the way I wanted it to. And I finally said, you know, God, you've taken charge of this. You know, you've always been in charge of this. And I'm finally recognizing that wherever this goes is where you want it to go. And finally, I was able to sleep well.
Oh.
Finally, I was able to write the story the way it was meant to be written. And when things happened that I found very disturbing, I would call my editors and with the fear of them saying, well, that kills it.
Oh, no.
And my wonderful editor, Matthew Dodonna, just would say, wow, this story just has everything, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it did. It just kept pouring out. But yeah, it was an incredible process.
Well, you did a great job. It's such a gift to the reader. You just keep turning the pages and there's something moving or suspenseful, and you're so hopeful through the whole book that everything's going to work out.
That's the beauty of it. It's taught me so much. I just feel so grateful that, you know, my preconceived notions are just blown out of the water. What some of this stuff really means, and, you know, what it's like to be homeless and what it's like to have an addiction that you can't. I suddenly realized that I had an addiction too that I didn't even realize.
Uh-oh. You know?
I was sitting talking to a chaplain at the New Orleans Mission one day. He was a recovered addict, like everybody there is. I said, first of all, describe what it's like to come down off of crack. What is that process like? And he described it to me in excruciating detail.
Wow,
amazing. And then I said, so what is it like to be addicted? I said, I need to know this stuff if I'm going to write it, because I've never been addicted to anything like this. And he said, oh, really? Oh, really? He said, check the closet. Check the closet and think about the things that you want to be and what stops you from being that. And see what it is that you keep going back to. Where are your failures? And I started thinking about him, and he was right. And I suddenly realized that we all have that in one way or another. And suddenly my eyes were open to what drove Jackie time and time again to crack cocaine. I suddenly got it.
Well, you were open to it.
So he was clean for 12 years at one point. And then when I found him back in New Orleans, he was clean for 3 years. And suddenly there was just this one day. You know, he has this battle every single day to stay clean, to fight off the demons. And then one day out of the last 1,200 days, he fails. And that's all it took.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it took. I've learned to be teachable.
We should all be teachable.
Some of us are just not teachable. Can we open our minds and to be able to learn? I think that's the whole point of the book, is that when Jackie said, you ought to do a story about me, I listened.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear what I expected to hear. And now when people tell me what addiction's like, instead of me judging them, saying, nah, you don't know what you're talking about. You just need to get your life together. You need to stop, you know, giving in to this stuff. I suddenly, okay, stop. Listen to what they have to say and see if you can't relate to it. And see if you can't then find ways to help them where they are. when I talked with Clarence Adams at the Osmond Inn, he taught me that if you can tell me how to stop an addict from returning to his addiction, then you can write a book. And as soon as you write the page, you have to tear it out, because what you figured out may work for one person, but will not work for the second person. That's an amazing lesson. Mm-hmm. We have our preconceived notions of how to deal with other people's problems, but we don't want people telling us how to deal with ours.
No kidding.
We know a little better.
Well, the great thing about this book is that not only are you teachable, but now you're the teacher, and it's a book that's filled with lessons for all of us about how to live more generously and give more to our communities and care more about the people in our world. It's an amazing book, Ted. So moving and so inspiring, and it's just the best. We've been talking with Ted Jackson, whose amazing new book is You Ought to Do a Story About Me, Addiction, An Unlikely Friendship, and the Endless Struggle for Redemption. Ted, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Susan.
Ted Jackson appears in a Zoom event with best-selling author Jonathan Eig, Tuesday, August 25th at 7 p.m. For more information, go to octaviabooks.com to sign up. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.